creating cultural awareness and understanding. This is Culture Click. Culture Click is written and produced by KQAL-FM on the campus of Winona State University.
On this episode of Culture Click, we take a look at Minnesota's sordid past that had connections right here in Winona. Elizabeth Hatley visited the Winona bookshelf to read and discuss her book, The Ku Klux Klan in Minnesota. What started off as an editorial piece in support of the construction of the Duluth Clayton Jackson McGee Memorial transformed into years of research. Learn surprising facts about the Klan and how Minnesota was one of the last states in the Midwest to disband the Klan's organization in the 1930s.
They knew what they were doing. I mean, they would go to the county fairgrounds. They would hire baseball teams to come in. Bands would come in. I mean, I was surprised about the organization.
Keep listening after the presentation for my one-on-one interview with Elizabeth. I'm Terry Tunset, and you're listening to Culture Click.
Thank you for everyone coming this evening. I'll just start with a quick little bit about Wabasha's Klan chapter from the book, and then there's several pictures that you'll probably recognize from Wabasha, the St. Felix Church, the Mason Building, and where they burned the crosses, at least for Wabasha, and we went up to that area and took a photograph, and you would have seen the crosses quite clearly that were burnt from town. Kevin's grandfather, John Foley, was appointed city attorney of Wabasha in May of 1916 and also served two terms as a district deputy. He was also great friends with Governor Floyd Olson, according to his grandson, Kevin. The Wabasha Catholic Church is located three blocks off Wabasha's main street. St. Felix Catholic Church was opened in Wabasha in 1915. Threats were made by the local Klan chapter to burn down the church next to the school in the early 1920s. John Foley arranged for a group of men with guns to be at the church to prevent that from happening. It's possible that the Mason Building in downtown Wabasha is where the Wabasha Ku Klux Klan chapter would meet, just as the Clay County Klan chapter did in the downtown Mason Building in Moorhead, Minnesota. The Wabasha Mason Building is located on 200 West Main. The building was altered in the 1920s when the second story windows were filled in. Klan crosses were burned at the Coffee Mill Hill, located directly across from Wabasha Highway 69, where the present-day Coffee Mill golf course is today. That's just one example. Now, who was the typical 1920s Klansman? The average Klan member was white, Protestant, and native stock. Native stock meant he was born in this country as well as his parents. What attracted people to the Klan? The Ku Klux Klan allowed KKK members to vent their hatred against Roman Catholics, Jews, Germans, immigrants, African Americans, and labor unions. Why did people join the Klan in the 1920s? By joining the Ku Klux Klan, members felt they were still in control of their communities and preserving their way of life. Where did Klan activity take place in Minnesota? I was able to document 51 Ku Klux Klan chapters spread throughout Minnesota. There were also women Klan chapters known as WKKK. I documented at least two WKKK chapters, one in Northfield, Minnesota, and the other in Owatonna, Minnesota. Now, I brought photographs of the Winona Klan chapter, and I'll just pass these. You guys can pass these around, take a look at them. Now, when did this start in Minnesota? The first confirmed newspaper documentation of the Ku Klux Klan being in Minnesota starts in 1920 in Minneapolis. Minnesota was one of the last Midwest states to give up on the Ku Klux Klan in 1930. The book came about after the original article about the KKK in Minnesota appeared in Minnesota History Magazine, published in 2010. After the article, further information came in. People were a little more comfortable with the skeletons in their closets, or in this case, should I say, the robes in their closet. The topic of the KKK in Minnesota came to my notice when the Duluth Clayton Jackson McGee Memorial was in the process of being constructed. My original purpose was to write an editorial in support of the memorial monument being built and bringing more attention to the work that was being done to achieve this memorial. I had known little about the Duluth lynchings that occurred June 15, 1920. My first thought when I began my research into the topic was the KKK operational in Minnesota at this time. I'd always associated lynchings and the Ku Klux Klan with the South, not something that happened here in the Midwest. At the Minnesota Historical Society, I began researching both topics, the lynchings in Duluth and the KKK. When I began that research at the Minnesota Historical Society is when the Duluth editorial became sidetracked. What happened in Minnesota involving the KKK became my main focus, and in large part due to finding the Minnesota Ku Klux Klan photo album. This particular album was put together by an Owatonna photography studio and is composed of numerous photographs of a Klan conclave that took place in Owatonna, Minnesota. A Klan conclave is a statewide gathering of Klan chapters. I had no idea that the KKK was so widespread in Minnesota until I saw the album. In the album are numerous photographs of all the Minnesota towns who had floats in the Klan parade held that weekend. The Klan album at the Minnesota Historical Society is titled Pleasant Pastimes. People who contacted me tell me that they had family members who belonged to the Minnesota KKK ask if I've come across family names in my research, which I have. I suggest Minnesotans who have heard family stories or found Klan items in their relative belongings go to the Minnesota Historical Society and take a look at the Klan album and see if they recognize anyone in it. Minnesota made it state law that in public settings, KKK members had to keep their faces unmasked. And as you can see, the Winona Klan chapters, their faces are unmasked. Minnesota not only had KKK chapters, but there were separate Klan WKKK chapters for the women in Minnesota as well. Minnesota Klan's women are well represented in the photo album as well. I found two Minnesota Klan newspapers, The Call of the North and The Fiery Cross, and began to put the information together regarding the KKK in Minnesota. While doing the research, I also came across a St. Paul newspaper, the Midway News, where every week this newspaper would publish the names, occupations, and Klan numbers of the members of the St. Paul Klan chapter. Also in the Midway News featured on their front page information about Klan activities going on across the state. The Midway News was very anti-Klan and wanted the KKK rooted out of Minnesota. The Midway News would give a great deal of information about how Minnesota Klan members were involved in Minnesota politics and American Legion participation. In particular, American Legion Secretary Stafford King, who was later to become Minnesota's state auditor for nearly four decades. It wasn't just King who belonged to the Klan or supported the Ku Klux Klan, other prominent Minnesotans did as well. Politics makes for strange bedfellows, but hopefully not ones wearing bedsheets. Theodore Christensen, who was the governor of Minnesota from 1925 to 1931, was in personal contact with Minnesota's Grand Dragon, H.E. Ketterling. Ketterling discusses personally visiting Minnesota Governor Christensen at his office. In one of the many letters exchanged between the two men, Grand Dragon H.E. Ketterling asks Governor Christensen to help a Klansman get a government job. Reverend Rothwell was a minister whose church is still located in Claremont, Minnesota. In the book is a photograph of members of Rothwell's church in their Klan robes posed in front of the church. Reverend Rothwell wrote to the Observer defending the Klan. Well, if the Roman Catholic will forswear his allegiance to the Pope, if the Jews will accept Christ as his personal savior, and if the Negro will become white, I have no doubt that they all could be admitted to the Klan. But you know as well as I that the real Romanists and the real Jew can but will not meet the requirements, and the Negro cannot. Please bear in mind that if you consider the Klan un-American because of its requirements for membership, then your church and mine is un-Christian, the KFC and all other lodges are unbrotherly, and Uncle Sam himself is unneighborly for exactly the same reason. What you don't know about the Klan will fill a large book. Therefore, unless your desire to pose as an agent of Romanism in St. Paul and continue to furnish the Dispatch copy for its propaganda against the Klan, I would suggest that you secure some real Klan literature and study it carefully, hoping to be advised when your eyes are open to the real facts regarding the Klan. I located the names of 10 Minneapolis Klan chapters, but local newspaper accounts reported that there were 14 Minneapolis area Klan chapters, which included suburbs such as Hopkins, Anoka, and Robbinsdale. At the time of the Minneapolis Klan trial, Hennepin County Sheriff Earl Brown admitted to having belonged to the KKK. His membership number was 0004. Brown was initiated into the Klan at the Dyckman Hotel in Minneapolis. Sheriff Earl Brown stated that the KKK was increasing in strength and that it was a course of wisdom for law enforcement officers to join the organization. The Minnesota Klan trial refers to when Floyd Olson was Hennepin County District Attorney and successfully tried members of Minneapolis Klan chapters who attempted to have Minneapolis Mayor Leach removed from his job. Earl Brown ran as the Republican nominee to become Minnesota's governor in 1932 and was defeated by Floyd Olson. In his later years, Earl Brown donated his estate to the University of Minnesota, telling U of M officials he was not the slightest bit interested in scholarships because there is too damn many people going to college now. Ray Chase's newspaper, the Anoka Herald, was a strong supporter of Earl Brown. The Chase family newspaper prints that the Ku Klux Klan was an indication of loyal Americans who will not to submit to the rule of Bolsheviks, Bentals, and Townleys. Also, the Anoka Herald would commonly refer to Minnesota citizens who were of German ancestry as German swine. Ray Chase ran for governor in 1930 and was soundly beaten by Floyd Olson. Never had a Republican candidate been so badly beaten. Chase carried only 5 of the 87 counties in Minnesota. Minnesota governor races from 1857 to 1960 were elected to 2-year terms. Since 1962, Minnesota governors have been elected to 4-year terms. Chase lost big in the nonpartisan League counties, German counties, and in the larger urban areas. Chase had been a vicious opponent of the nonpartisan League, charging it with having designs against private property rights, supporting unions, and unchristian. Ray Chase, when Minnesota state auditor, was accused of mismanaging conservation in northern Minnesota. He was asked who exactly he was selling state lumber to and why at such a low price. His second-in-command, Otto Dirks, father of 4 sons, commits suicide while Ray Chase was auditor. This is covered in greater detail in the book also. Stafford King's collection of papers are located at the Minnesota Historical Society. The King papers are composed of 57 boxes of material. King kept meticulous and almost narcissistic records of his career with the American Legion as Minnesota state auditor. Stafford saved every single thing, including his KKK membership card. Now, I sent a copy of his card to Central Michigan University, which has the largest collection of KKK membership cards, and it's identical to the ones in his collection. Stafford King's assigned Ku Klux Klan number was 1233, and there's a copy of his membership card in the book. Considering the amount of detail King paid attention to his career and life, it was noticeable how in box 37 of his collection, he made a point of not keeping his day planners from 1922 to 1926, peak Klan years. In 1924, questions were being asked about King's involvement with the Ku Klux Klan. Letters are written to King asking if the rumors he belongs to the Klan are true. He did resign his American Legion secretary position in 1925, working for several years in the Veterans Office at a desk job. King then later returned to public life, running as a Republican for Minnesota State Auditor in 1930. He became Minnesota State Auditor for the next 4 decades. An important hot button issue that Minnesota Klan chapters backed was evolution not being taught in Minnesota public schools. This was the decade when the Scopes Monkey Trial in Tennessee took place in 1925. William Riley was a personal friend of William Jennings Bryan. William Bell Riley, known as the architect of fundamentalism and the founder of Northwestern College in St. Paul, was the leading voice to have evolution thrown out of Minnesota public schools and Minnesota public universities, including the University of Minnesota. On March 9, 1927, an anti-evolution bill was held up for vote in the Minnesota House and Senate, where it was finally defeated in a close, hotly debated vote. The Nonpartisan League was a political organization that wanted to reduce the power of corporate businesses. Exploited by powerful corporate and political interests in Minneapolis and St. Paul, Minnesota farmers began banded together to fight their political and economic rights to fight for them. A letter written by County Attorney Nicholas shows how early the Minnesota establishment began going after the Nonpartisan League and how despised the organization was by conservative interests in Minnesota. Written to the members of the Public Safety Commission by the County Attorney of Jackson County, E.H. Nicholas tells the commission, "This vicious doctrine being promoted by the Nonpartisan League is of the same character is that which German propagandists have been spreading throughout the world and which has been paid for with German money. Is it any wonder that many men of pro-German tendencies have been quick to align themselves with this organization? The doctrine above set forth is the same as that preached in Russia under the guise of a newfound freedom and which deceived its people with the promise of lands and wealth and which finally resulted in a complete collapse of all government law and order." It was disturbing to learn that the Duluth Klan chapter started organizing within a year after the lynchings. The Duluth Klan chapter would meet at the Owl's Club Room on 118 East 2nd Street. They met there on a weekly basis, and the meeting place was less than 3 blocks from where the young men were dragged from the jail that night. I was given the Duluth Klan membership list from 1925 and 1926. These two Duluth Klan chapter lists had some big names on it of people who belonged to the Klan, including the president of the Minnesota State Commissioners. There's further detail on the Duluth leaders who were Klan members of the Duluth chapter. The Catholic bishop in Duluth at the time was Bishop Welch, who employed a spy to attend the Duluth Klan meetings, where he got a hold of the Duluth KKK memberships. The lists also include the Duluth Klan member occupations and home addresses. Also on the Klan list in 1925 and 1926 was Sergeant Olson, who played such a large role, or lack of role, at the jail the night the young men were lynched. Not exactly politically correct on the part of Sergeant Olson to join the Ku Klux Klan after telling the state that you did everything you could save those men that night. I was also given access to Archbishop Dowling's papers, who was the Archbishop of St. Paul and Minneapolis during the 1920s. In his papers is a hate file from the 1920s. And that's exactly what the Archbishop Dowling labeled that particular file, the hate file. The Irish population in Minnesota during the 1920s was less than 10%, and the African American population in Minnesota was less than 1%. The letters in the hate file written to Archbishop Dowling stereotype all Catholics as criminals and responsible for all the social ills that occur in society. If they, Catholics, were only good and loyal Americans, not taking direction from their leader, the Pope, the world would be a better place. The last Midwest KKK dragon was elected out of Minnesota in 1930, and he was the mayor of St. James, Minnesota, Dr. C.E. McNaught. In the 1920s, the two main newspapers in St. James, the St. James Plains Dealer and the St. James Independent, were one was supporting the mayor, the other one was not supporting the mayor. Editor Haslett, the editor of the St. James Independent, printed in his newspaper an interview he had with a Klan representative who came to speak to him. Haslett strongly disagreed with what the Klan organizer was telling him about the Ku Klux Klan organization. The published interview in the newspaper seemed to be an attempt on Haslett's part to expose the KKK for what it truly stood for. Haslett sold his newspaper in 1926, passing away in 1942. After the St. James Independent changed ownership, there was no longer any further negative coverage of Dr. McNaught in that newspaper. In Fairmont, the Martin County Ku Klux Klan representative was still running for city and county office in 1932. He was also the Republican secretary for Martin County. His name was G. Fred Anderson, and he is also one of the signers on the mortgage for the Martin County Clavering. The Martin County Sheriff William Carter was outed as a Klan member by the Midway News. Fairmont had extensive coverage of their Klan activities, and there's further and more detailed information regarding Fairmont and what they did. Also in the book is a photograph of the Martin County Clavering, and a clavering is the Klan name for a meeting place. And it was purchased by the Martin County Klan chapter. And there, like I said, there's a photograph in the book. Now today, and the building is still there, it's a Mexican grocery store. David Stevenson raped a woman who later committed suicide when she was finally allowed to return home when Stevenson released her. He was sent to jail. But where did the former Grand Dragon, the infamous David Stevenson, go after he was let out of jail? Robbinsdale, Minnesota. He was arrested for violating the conditions of his parole by leaving the state of Indiana and sent back to Indiana. This arrest occurred in 1950. George Fedor, now 82 years old, was a technical illustrator for over 50 years. He got to know everybody at WCCO, and Charlie Boone even interviewed George about the Minnesota Ku Klux Klan. George grew up in Robbinsdale. He remembers hearing stories about his maternal uncle belonging to the Minnesota Ku Klux Klan and being a high-ranking member of the KKK in the 1930s. George told me that on the east side of Lake Crystal, of Crystal Lake, families came from all over the state pitching tents to camp a couple weeks there to attend the Robbinsdale conclaves. These particular late summer conclaves were held on top of the hill, directly across from what is North Memorial Hospital today. George's maternal uncle held a high-ranking Minnesota Klan position, and according to his nephew, even had his own private labeled parking space during the summer conclaves. Large circus tents were provided for the Klan meetings. Minnesota Klan members would meet every day for 2 weeks in the late summer. Also, crosses were burnt during the convention every night during the Robbinsdale conclaves. There were heavily armed and robed Klansmen around the whole woods that still existed then to make sure no troublemakers showed up. According to George, thousands of Klansmen with their families attended these annual summer Klan conclaves held in Robbinsdale through the late 1920s into the early 1930s. 7 months previous to the Duluth lynchings in East Grand Forks, Minnesota, the 17-year-old Edna Warner was found dead. Two black men were arrested within 24 hours of finding Miss Warner's body and brought to the East Forks jail. Mobs organized in Grand Forks, North Dakota, and in East Grand Forks, Minnesota, marching to the local jail to lynch the two men. Is it possible what happened in East Grand Forks, Minnesota in October 1919 may have given the alleged Duluth victim, Irene Tuscan, the idea 7 months later to accuse the black circus workers of rape? The Duluth Herald gave extensive coverage to the Warner murder. The sheriff of East Grand Forks, Sheriff Bolstead, secretly rushed the black men to the Crookston, Minnesota jail. The mob found out and started for Crookston. Sheriff Bolston again moved his prisoners by train to the Ramsey County Jail in St. Paul. One law enforcement officer in East Grand Forks did what dozens of police officers in Duluth did not. Kept his prisoners safe and made sure they were granted their legal rights. Lynchings are murders carried out in public with the knowledge of the entire community. In East Grand Forks, two black men were immediately moved to secure jails for their protection. Accounts of lynchings reveal that mob action is averted only when local law enforcement remove a potential victim from the jurisdiction or convey clearly to the members of the lynch mob that they will be shot if they proceed with the lynchings. After the Duluth lynchings, the Grand Forks Herald wrote, the lynchings were a disgrace to the Duluth police force, writing, the officials of the city are responsible for them. It was the business of these officials to keep them safe, even at the cost of their own lives. They failed in their duty. NAACP Secretary Walter Wright writes a letter to Governor Bernquist after the Duluth lynchings, telling the governor how evidence has been secured since the Duluth lynchings that clearly established that the three lynched in Duluth were not guilty of criminal assault upon the white girl involved. Governor Bernquist never made a state or national statement declaring the young black men lynched in Duluth were innocent. And to the best of my knowledge, the state of Minnesota has never made a formal statement acknowledging these men were innocent. The Mankato Free Press writes that there should be less outrage over the lynchings of the African-American men and more concern over the frail victim, Irene Tuscan. That frail victim lived to the ripe old age of 94. The Mankato Press tells the city of Duluth that their city was not disgraced and that in a few years, people will have forgotten the incident. Within 5 months of the lynchings, Dutch Jeromas, a documented Duluth Klan member and a close friend of Stafford King's, starts a 48-8 chapter in Duluth. 48-8 chapters were a secret society of the American Legion, and only white, native stock Protestant veterans were asked to join. American Legion members who belonged to the Klan in the 1920s or supported the Klan worked around the anti-Klan sentiment in the American Legion by joining the 48-8. The 48-8 chapters were finally thrown out of the National American Legion by Judge Daniel Foley from Wabasha, Minnesota in 1960. And there's a lot more detail about Judge Foley from Wabasha in the book. The climate in Duluth was very receptive to Klan recruiters immediately after the lynchings, when the opposite should have been the case. It is distinctly possible in the following months after the lynchings, the startup of a Klan chapter in Duluth so soon afterwards may have provided connections to help in the cover-up of whoever played a role in the lynchings that night. Many of the right people in Duluth joined the Duluth Klan chapter, people who had the power and the political positions to make sure that no one else was further punished and that the lynchings would be forgotten as quickly as possible. Racism went underground in Duluth, and former Duluth Klan members continued in positions of local power to the late 1970s. African Americans in Duluth were denied housing. They were shut out of certain neighborhoods. They were denied jobs. Blacks weren't hired for professional positions. And in the 1940s, blacks were forbidden from teaching or even student teaching in Duluth schools. In the Duluth chapter list were several men who worked in the Duluth Fire Department who did belong to the Klan. The first African-American fireman in Duluth had to go to court to get hired, and that was in 1971. Minnesotans knew that the Ku Klux Klan was involved in Minnesota politics, and it was reported on in the newspapers. According to 1920s author Arthur Jacobs and former Republican insider, Republican business leaders used the Minnesota Klan chapters to break up the nonpartisan league. Further detail about exactly who those Minnesota business leaders were and what they did is in the book. Minnesota business leaders wanted the word to be put out there that the nonpartisan league was socialist, affiliating it with atheist Russia. This allowed an opening for the Protestant Klan chapters to add new members and pull Protestant farmers out of the nonpartisan league. Brown, Chase, and King all made attempts to become the governor of Minnesota. In King's case, several attempts. But they could not overcome their past involvement or support of the 1920s KKK. It was reported to the Minneapolis City Council members that officers of the Minneapolis Police Force had enrolled as members of the Ku Klux Klan. A city meeting is held about this January 12, 1923. The city council, including the mayor, wanted the Minneapolis chief of police to investigate the activities of the Klan in his department and to report back at once to the mayor and the city council. The mayor and the Minneapolis council wanted all city departments to be investigated for Klan members and Klan activities. Also in the city council meeting notes was a motion made by Alderman Scott requesting that a color woman be appointed as a police officer in the city of Minneapolis. Respectfully report and recommend that the woman be certified by the Civil Service Commission as a police officer. I'm sure that the Minneapolis Klan police officers weren't happy hearing about having black female officers either. In a paper entitled "The Voices of the Knights of the Ku Klux Klan, Charges That Were False, Malicious, and Libelous Against the Mayor" were published in the newspaper. The Hennepin County attorney at the time, Floyd Olson, brought charges against several members of Minneapolis Klan chapters. The jury convicted the defendants of criminal libel. Newspaper coverage of the Minneapolis Klan trial was reported daily beginning in April of 1923. From the stand, Mayor George Leach testified that he had been solicited numerous times to join the Ku Klux Klan, and his refusals resulted in him being threatened by the organization. Mayor Leach was even physically threatened during the trial and told, "You better drop this matter," referring to the libel charges, "or there will be trouble." The mayor said that he believed these threats were now meant not only against him, but now his staff as well. In the newspaper, The Voices of the Knights of the Ku Klux Klan, an affidavit from Miss Kennedy appeared. In this published affidavit, she tells in detail how Mayor Leach would come to see her. Mayor Leach was a married man. The trial was the first time Mayor Leach had ever seen Miss Kennedy. Miss Kennedy, a resident of Minneapolis, also states in her affidavit that she was paying off graft money to City Detective Ludwig Glarum, with the mutual understanding that it was for absolute police protection. Payments were made upon demand and ranged from $25 to $100 per payment. This affidavit from Miss Kennedy was given to and notarized by Shirley Reichel, one of the Klan defendants. Shirley Reichel was a student at the University of Minnesota at this time. During his closing argument, County Attorney Olson referred to Miss Kennedy during the trial as a fine mouthpiece of the invisible Klan. During the 1923 trial, over 200 names were given at that trial of identified Ku Klux Klan members. Attorney Michael Freeman gave me access to all the information that he had. That list of names should have been in the Hennepin County Courthouse file, but they weren't. Most of the documentation currently at the Hennepin County Courthouse was from the 1925 appeal trial, which contains some documentation from the 1923 trial. The last time the file was checked out of the Hennepin County Courthouse was in the early 1970s. Accidentally, intentionally, I'm not sure, possibly someone took the bulk of the 1923 documents, or they weren't returned to the file. The ironic thing about the Klan trial was that during the 1925 appeal trial, they did find out Miss Kennedy was seeing someone that was involved with the Minneapolis administration, but it wasn't Mayor Leach or anyone on his staff. Several cab drivers testified at the 1925 appeal trial that it was the assistant county attorney, William Compton, who would visit Miss Kennedy. The taxi drivers stated these were short meetings. The assistant county attorney would have less than an hour-long visits with Miss Kennedy, cab drivers picking him up about as quickly as they dropped him off. The cab drivers also commented the assistant county attorney would tell them he wasn't any county rube and not to overcharge him, dropping him off and picking him up from Miss Kennedy's place. After the Minneapolis Klan trial was over, the Northwest Bulletin, a black newspaper published in St. Paul, bravely came out and stated how happy they were with bringing Minneapolis Klan members to a trial, a brave thing for a black newspaper to publicly state. The jury verdict, according to the Northwest Bulletin, though, was not sufficient to convince Minnesota Klansmen to quit the Klan or change their attitudes. The black community expresses the hope that the fight against the Klan will continue. The National Observer reports, after the Minneapolis Klan trial, a leading national Klan organizer spoke at a Klan rally in Austin, Minnesota, that the conditions that existed in Minneapolis under Mayor Leach and District Attorney Olson's administrations had been examined and checked upon by the national organization of the Ku Klux Klan. The National Ku Klux Klan was outraged that Minneapolis Klan chapters had gone after the mayor the way they had, by slandering his reputation and threatening him the way they had. Also stated in the Austin speech, the National Ku Klux Klan claims to have spent $21,000 investigating conditions and had found Minneapolis exceptionally clean, but reporting that in one day, Klan investigators, as they recalled, made over 60 buys of liquor in one day. This particular Klan speech sounds as if all the Ku Klux Klan was trying to do was be helpful to the city of Minneapolis and not hurt city officials. Klan's organizer Gross offered to turn over what they'd found out about conditions to city attorneys, the Klan doing nothing more than being just good citizens. Mayor Leach later writes that to this day, 1945, the Klan has not been active in Hennepin County. The 1923 Minneapolis Klan trial and the 1925 Minneapolis Klan appeal trials did not stop Klan activity in Hennepin County or in the rest of Minnesota. Minnesota newspapers report St. James Mayor McNaught being elected Midwest Dragon in 1930 at a large picnic gathering in St. Paul, Minnesota. From the Medelia Times-Messenger, October 3, 1930, Dr. McNaught, mayor of St. James, was the principal speaker at the picnic in St. Paul, Sunday, of the Knights of the Ku Klux Klan. Dr. McNaught was elected Grand Dragon of the Tri-State Realm at this meeting. And from what Mayor Leach wrote in 1945, he was implying until 1945, it took that long to completely clean the Ku Klux Klan out of Minnesota. Now, some of what I've been referring to are from complete letters, newspaper articles that I couldn't include in the book. But St. Thomas University has put all this information, the letters, like the letters between the governor and the Grand Dragon and the complete newspaper articles, with PBT slides, and there's copies of these documents. And if you want to see the full letter and the full document in the newspaper, all you have to do is go to St. Thomas University website, pull up the Ku Klux Klan in Minnesota and Elizabeth Dorsey Hatley, and you can see the complete original documents. Some people have asked me what I hope to achieve with the writing of this book. First, it was to have detailed and factually based information that the KKK thrived in the state, and that a number of Minnesotans either belonged to or supported the Ku Klux Klan's goals in the 1920s. A question I have, and I still have, why was Minnesota one of the last Midwest states to give up on the KKK? In light of Charleston, South Carolina, knowing one's history is important. Quoting President Obama, we do not know whether the killer of Reverend Pinckney and eight others knew the history of this church, the president said, but he surely sensed the meaning of his violent act. It was an act that drew on a long history of bombs and arsons and shots fired at churches. Not random, but as a means of control, a way to terrorize and oppress. Moral and racial views were turned into political stances and enforced on Minnesota residents who did not all have the same religion or culture that members of the Minnesota KKK had. There was a judgment rather than an acceptance on the parts of Minnesota residents who belonged to Klan chapters towards others of different backgrounds. It is time for Minnesota to acknowledge a painful part of our history and move forward to build a more honest and inclusive Minnesota. History exposes hate groups and their members. Some people in reaction to this book have said to me, well, that's just how people thought then, or they didn't know any better. Hate is hate no matter when it occurs or how it occurs. We can't hide from these hard truths about race, religion, justice in America. We can't change history, but I believe we can change how we interact with each other, learning about our past mistakes. I ended the book with a quote from Minnesota poet Bill Holm, "Only the dead are pure, and then only in memory, never in fact." I hope those who read this book will see there's concrete information to prove conclusively the KKK found a home in Minnesota and flourished here. Thank you, everyone, for coming this evening. If you have any questions, let's go for it.
Yeah, I was interested in your reference to the WKKK. Was that something that was found outside of Minnesota, too, or was it just an aberration here?
No, it was found outside of Minnesota, and actually there was three different kinds of branches of the women's KKK, depending on which, like, the one in Northfield and the one in Owatonna is the Camellia branch. So now, I don't know if you get a personal preference or you like these particular Klan women versus other Klan women, but yeah, and in Northfield and in Owatonna, they had banners with white roses on them, and they had their own particular sashes and what they did, too.
So. One more question, if I may. As I guess you would say, a fallen away Lutheran, I noticed how much of the Klan hatred was focused against blacks, against Roman Catholics, etc. Was there any particular tie-in ethnically or religiously that was predominant within the Klan, or?
Well, one of the reasons why they burn crosses, and the reason for having a burning cross was that the Protestant religion was a live, breathing representation of Christ compared to the dead Catholic cross of Rome. So that was one of the symbolisms, you know, that they used. But yeah, the Protestant, I mean, it was definitely heavy in with the Protestants belonging. But they didn't like Jewish people, they didn't like black people, they didn't like, you know, I mean.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for writing your book and for coming here tonight. And I've done a little bit of research on the Klan. My grandfather was in the Klan in Michigan in the 1920s. And I found that a book was written about the Klan, Everyday Klansmen. And the author of that book claims that 8 out of 10 of the eligible members for being in the Klan were in the Klan in the county where I'm from in Michigan.
Yeah, I think and same thing in Indiana, too. I mean, it was, yeah, I have read that about Michigan, and I've read that about Indiana, that it was pretty, and then it wasn't just the fact of belonging to the Klan. They dominated the city offices, they dominate the school boards, they dominate the library boards, you know, so that was playing a role, too. I mean, they were pretty politically savvy when you look back at it. So, no, I'm not, yeah, Michigan was pretty heavy duty. That's where I went to the Central Michigan University. You could probably find, if you want.
Oh, I've been there, yeah.
Okay.
And I've seen his membership card, and one of the people he was in the Klan with was a man named Dan Gerber, who at the time was the head of the Fremont Canning Company, which became Gerber Baby Food. And so when you see that little white baby,
let that come to mind.
Yeah. and maybe just one last thing. When you mentioned it took till 45?
45. And I mean, some of the stuff for just the St. James mayor, you know, Iowa was pulling out of it. The Dakotas were pulling out of it. Wisconsin was starting to pull out of it. And Minnesota was not, you know, that's kind of disturbing. And then talking to some, like with the Robbins tale, where he said they were still getting together in 31, 32, 33, where, like I said, the rest of the country was pretty disillusioned by it. So that's bothersome, you know.
Yeah, and I just wonder, I mean, in relationship to that, to get rid of the Klan, to what degree it's sort of embedded within the social networks.
Well, look at how many guys kept their jobs. I mean, like the Minnesota State Auditor here in Minnesota. He just kept getting elected, and the people knew. They didn't want him to be governor, but it was okay for him to be auditor, mm-hmm. you know. I mean, it's an underground kind of a racism thing where, that was just then, you know. But you had your card and you had your robe, and you paid your fees.
I'm interested mostly in what triggered your curiosity that you used a lot of primary sources and really had to really dig deeply. What got you going?
It was the Duluth lynchings.
Okay.
And like I said, and then I was looking up information about the Duluth lynchings. Then I found out they were keeping track, the NAACP back then, and there was another organization, a black organization, and they were keeping track of the lynchings in the United States. And Minnesota was top, I think it was actually the third in the whole country that had lynched the most blacks in 1920. And you know, you think of Alabama or North Carolina, I mean, you know. So, and then I thought, well, was there any Klan influence? And bam, there was that Klan album.
Yeah, you made a reference to a streak of anti-German sentiment. That's sort of a new one to me on any of the reading I've done on the Klan.
Well,
is that strictly
it
a Minnesota,
was Minnesota
thing?
That was a Minnesota thing. And I think that was because the Germans were the newest immigrant group that came in during World War I. And that was the backlash that was, you know, we do get a little, don't like things to change too much. And I think that was, the Germans were the first biggest immigrant group that came in. And plus there was the feelings about World War I. I ran across all kinds of letters where people were reporting their German neighbors not contributing to the Red Cross or making a point out sending their sons to World War I. And that hostility continued. I mean, plus the Germans, there was a pretty good sized Catholic population, you know. So, yeah, it's pretty bad, some parts of Minnesota against the Germans. Waseca, down in southern Minnesota, Albert Lea, very anti-German. Ellendale, Owatonna. But you could see little pockets wherever the Germans settled more, where the hostility was.
Geographically, where did the Klan seem to center?
Everywhere, because I got my county map out and put little dots on every time I, you know. The only place was way up in the corner of northwest Minnesota, where I think it's just woods, basically. that was about the only area. So,
considering how many Native Americans in Minnesota at that time, was there much activity against the Native Americans?
I've been asked that when I was up in Duluth, and I didn't see the Klan making an issue out of that. But I did come across correspondence, especially with lumber and land being taken from Native Americans. And I think that's what was being actively done against that population in the 1920s. I think those guys that were in positions of power, belonged to the Klan at that time period, were taking advantage.
I find it interesting you're talking about St. Felix. My mom grew up in Wabasha. And as I was organizing for Minnesotans United, of course, on their school fence, they had the marriages between one man and one woman, so it's interesting to see how hate kind of evolves.
It swung all the way around where they were persecuted before, and
And then, of course, that's not speaking for everyone who belongs to that church, because there are many Catholics who completely disagree with their hierarchy, but it was just interesting to see that.
And you kind of wonder if they know what the history was. And I mean, like I said, reading that hate file, Archbishop Dowling, I mean, the Catholics were more likely to be part of the prison population. The Catholics were not going to the public schools, and our teachers weren't trained. I mean, I could send you some of those. I wasn't able to put all that in there. But
it's also interesting that you brought up Austin, because there's still a very underground, not too underground, but somewhat underground. Even though they're not the KKK, they're still vehemently xenophobic, anti-immigrant.
I heard from somebody from Austin just a week ago that was talking about that. And one of the Klan defendants of the five was a guy from Austin. And he was prosecuted, and then he went back to Austin, had a nice career in his obituary. He was an upstanding member of the community, and they didn't say a word about him being convicted in the Klan trial. Yeah, Austin's an interesting place.
Well, thank you very
much. I'm Terry Tunset, and you're listening to Culture Clip. Up next is my interview with Elizabeth Hatley on her adventures in writing the Ku Klux Klan in Minnesota. We're with Elizabeth Hatley, who has written a book about the KKK in Minnesota and just gave a talk at the Bookshelf in downtown Winona. Elizabeth, how long did it take you to obtain your research, and how did you organize yourself?
Probably the research started originally with publishing and getting published in Minnesota History Magazine, an article about the Klan in Minnesota, but there was only 5,000 words that was the limit. And as I did the research, more and more information came out. But I started that in 2008, and that was published in 2010. And then I had the material, putting the article together, and kept going. And then the book was published at the end of 2013. So about 5 years, you know, but then they do all the editing and all that stuff, which is a torturous process.
Did you self-edit or?
No, editor Kaplan for Minnesota History Magazine edited it. Boy, did I learn a lot from her. And then the History Press, Ben Gibson did the editing on that. So, but they send it back to you and then you send it back and...
Fun stuff. Torturous process. How did you organize yourself? Were there note cards everywhere, or what was your process like?
Actually, the process was organizing it state or county by county, and then I would go to the county historical society and find out the names of the newspapers, and then go through the newspapers to find out, you know. What, I mean, they did get a lot of newspaper coverage back then. So, and then on, like, the Duluth Klan list, all I had to do there was to go and take the names off the list and then work, you know, you could go to the Historical Society and they had collections of papers, especially Stanford King. He had 57 boxes. So I was able to connect who he was communicating with to other names that I had been coming across. So, like, cross-referencing. And then, again, keeping track of, you know, the counties and wherever there was any kind of Klan activity.
Did you meet any opposition while obtaining your research?
No, not any opposition, except once in a while people didn't want to talk about the subject and thought that was in the past. But at the same time, there was people that were also contacting me, whether it was through email or finding me on social media or talking to other people that I talked to who remembered stories growing up about Klan activity. And those were really vivid memories for those people. So that age group would have been like the grandchildren of Klan members back then. So they were in their 80s and 90s. They're in their 80s and 90s. And if they were Jewish or came from immigrant or Catholic families, They had some very, very vivid memories of seeing crosses burned, and then, like, at some of the farms where people came dressed in Klan robes and terrorized them at their farms by running their horses through the farms and things like that. I mean, it made quite an impression on the people that remember hearing the stories or their families experience Klan behavior.
What stories or facts have you learned since publishing your book?
Just like with George Fedor, who told me about all the information about Robbinsdale, and actually going to have lunch with George, and George is going to take us up and show us where the original, now of course it's all residential area because it's across from North Memorial, but he's got a pretty good idea of where the original campgrounds were, so we're going to have lunch and go up there with him. And you can track down who owned the property. So if I can get a couple of those addresses, I could do a property search. That's how I found the couple of the other Klan properties, because Klan chapters would buy property.
I think it's interesting because a lot of people don't associate the Ku Klux Klan with Minnesota. Are you surprised by that?
I was surprised originally, but then I became less and less surprised. So... And how they made it such a part of life. I mean, their church activities, their business activities, going to the Klan conclaves where they'd go to the baseball games and they would have their parades, and it was just normal family activity. How well they incorporated it. That was kind of bothersome and creepy, too. But
anything else that was very surprising to you?
No, not so much surprising. Once I figured out the pattern and behavior, and they pretty much set up, you know, their Klan chapters, and then they do the same thing, the cross-burning and the meetings and the parades. I mean, it was pretty well established. I mean, they had a pretty good program when you think about it. I mean, it was pretty well organized. They knew where they were going. They knew what they were doing. I mean, they would go to the county fairgrounds. They would hire baseball teams to come in. Bands would come in. I mean, I was surprised about the organization.
Oh,
the more,
yeah.
You know, the more I...
The level of it?
Yeah. I mean, they did a pretty good job when you think about it. I mean, how they got it all together. And then taking over the city positions, that was a little scary, too, how they'd go in. Taking over the auditor, the county boards, the school boards. Duluth had all the school boards in Hibbing and Virginia and Duluth that had Klan members on them.
You had talked a little bit about the women's organizations within the Ku Klux Klan. Why do you think there were so many less women's organizations versus men?
I don't know if there was, because Northfield and Owatonna seemed pretty organized to me. They belonged. They were the ones who made the picnics. They baked the chicken. They got the church things organized. I mean, there was Klan teen groups, too, where the kids could belong to. In the Northfield Women's Klan, Maggie Lee, who's passed away, was a reporter for the newspaper there. And her father belonged to the Klan, but her mother wasn't. You know, she attended a couple of the Women's Klan meetings, but they would make the robes and do the, you know, not make the robes, but fix and repair and that kind of thing. So I think there had to have been more out there of women's clans, not just Northfield and Owatonna.
Do you think they were as active as the men's groups?
I think they had to take a more passive role, you know, just because of the time period, the 1920s. But Northfield and Owatonna, they were right out there. Because the women clan chapters were very anti-alcohol. And the Klan was very anti-alcohol. So they supported prohibition, and women back then wanted the bars closed, and they wanted the alcohol gone. So that was a big selling point, getting the women involved with the Klan, keeping the men out of the bars.
What are your plans to do with the additional information you found?
I don't know. I'm going to just keep getting it and putting it, you know, some things are... Like I said, the Robbinsdale information I just got and finding another Klan-owned piece of property, but I've got something else I want to do next, so I'll just add to it.
Are there any other books you want to write?
Yeah, I want to do an article on consumption for Minnesota history, and then I could take the Klan information and the consumption, which was the White Plague in the 20s, and I'd like to do something on poor farms, because Minnesota had a lot of poor farms. And isolated their undesirables out in these buildings, and that was pretty common Minnesota practice back then.
You kind of like the edgy stuff, don't you?
The disenfranchised, I preferred.
What is it about history that fascinates you?
It keeps repeating itself. I mean, some of the behavior I see, you know, we're seeing today. I mean, look at what happened, like I said, in South Carolina. I mean, when are we going to look back and acknowledge some of that and start changing? You know, there was a woman today at the book thing who was talking about native stock and feeling if you move someplace else, you're not native stock and you're treated different. I mean, it's just those tiny little things, but, you know. And then one group will capitalize on it and take advantage of a group that's less franchise. That's been going on since time started.
Have you always been a writer?
Yeah, I was doing some other stuff, but it was just history articles and things like that. So it's just finding a big enough topic and trying to tie all the pieces together.
So what if some of the other work that you have accomplished, what is?
Oh, it's been medieval history and a British history. I mean, stuff that was really, a couple of people probably read it. Oh, and Good Housekeeping Thing, and a couple of women's stuff. And Minnesota Women's Press, writing some things there too. But it's not history, you know. I mean, there's writing, and then there's what you really like doing.
If people want to find out more information about you, do you have a website or a Facebook page or some form of social media?
The Facebook, you can reach me at. And a lot of people who had relatives who wanted to ask questions about their relatives have found me on Facebook. So it's Elizabeth Dorsey Hatley. And the book is The History Press, and you can contact them for any information and anything else you want to do regarding the book, this particular book, yeah. So,
I look forward to the piece on consumption.
Thanks for meeting with me.
Thank you very much, Teresa, for having me.
Thanks again to Elizabeth Hatley for sharing with us on Culture Click. More information on Elizabeth and her book, The Ku Klux Klan in Minnesota, can be found on Facebook. I'm Terry Tensett, and you've been listening to Culture Click.
Creating cultural awareness and understanding. You've been listening to Culture Click. Support for Culture Click is made possible by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Culture Click is produced by KQAL-FM on the campus of Winona State University. For more information, look us up on the web at kqal.org. And thanks for listening to Culture Click.